is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, April 15th, 2019. I'm Buster Olney. Josh Macri, our producer just about every day during the year, is back from vacation. Josh, welcome back.
Thank you, Buster. It's good to be back. Had a good couple days away, a few days away, actually. Got some warmth, got some sunshine, did some beach time, Buster. I know how much you hate the beach, but glad
all right,
to be.
How tan are you?
I get like a crimson color.
Okay, and then it's gone within like 24 hours.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, yeah, it lingers a little bit. You know, I have a little bit of Mediterranean blood in me. So you know, I get some color, but it's not that olive color that that is ideal. It's more of a red, and then it, yeah, certainly within a week it's gone. No question about that.
Yeah, good thing. The tan was never a lure for you when you were single, right? Good thing you found someone who'll take pity on you.
No question about it. And she gets nice and bronze, unlike myself. So I guess I won the end of that deal.
Nice. Well, you know what April 15th means, right? It's tax day.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
Yeah, Josh, have you paid the man the money?
Oh, Buster. I done paid the man his money. I paid the man his money back in January. I already cashed my refund check, and you're kind of
wow.
A weirdo if you have.
Well, that's how you went on vacation, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's 2019, yeah. Buster. Get that done. Get it done.
See, I don't know where you grew up, but I know the farmers I grew up around, they were waiting till the last possible second to roll in their return. Maybe that culture's changed up in Vermont. I don't know. It's also a baggage claim Monday, and it's Jackie Robinson Day across Major League Baseball, and the legacy of Jackie Robinson will be celebrated in the game today. Some news and notes as we get going. Angels outfielder Mike Trout is improving. He will travel with the team. He did not make the trip to Chicago with the Angels over the weekend. Clayton Kershaw will make his first start of the season Monday, coming off the injured list. In Atlanta last night on Sunday Night Baseball, man, the Braves went after Jacob deGrom.
Here comes a 1-0. Swing and a high fly ball. Well struck right field. Towards the corner. Gone! Nick Markakis turning on one. Markakis will touch them all. And we're tied up. One apiece as he takes the Cy Young Award winner, Gene. 2-2. Swing and a drive. Well struck left center field. That one back there. And that one is gone. A line drive homer over the left center field fence. A rocket off the bat of Josh Donaldson. And the Braves have added another, and it is now 3-1 Atlanta.
Boog Sciombe, the legend on ESPN Radio. The Braves take game four of that series, so the two sides split. In Jacob deGrom's last two starts, he's allowed 5 homers. And if you remember, in 2018, he allowed 10 for the entire year. He talked about his outing after the game.
Not really throwing the ball where I want to right now. Kind of cutting the fastball, you know, yanking the slider. Changeup's good at times, but other times it's not. So I don't know if it's something mechanical. I have to get in there and look and figure it out. I didn't really look at it. You know, that was, I go back to that year I had those two really bad ones in a row. I got looking at too much video. So I was just working in between, trying to get everything where I wanted to, and I felt good warming up. Felt good first couple innings. Even the pitch that Nick hit was a good pitch. I honestly went and looked at that and don't really know how he kept it fair. He just got to it and was able to hit it. And then, you know, Donaldson, that ball was supposed to be in, left it over the middle.
Jacob deGrom had an unusual path to becoming the best pitcher on the planet. We're going to hear more about that later in the podcast. The Rangers and the Athletics played, and the Rangers came back in the 8th inning.
Set by Soria, the pitch swung on and drilled to right center field. That is up the alley. It is in there for extra bases. 2 scores. Cabrera around third. He's being waved to the plate. Here comes the throw. The slide. He's safe and the game is tied. And all the way to third goes Danny Santana. 1-1. The pitch. The Shields bunts. Third base side. Out to get it. The catcher Fegley throws the first. It's late. Delino beats out the bunt. And the Rangers lead 8-7. A perfectly placed bunt up the third baseline. Fegley did a great job to get out there, but he had to spin around to throw, and Delino simply beat the throw to give the Rangers the lead.
Eric Nedel, the Hall of Famer, on 105.3, the Fan. Texas wins that game 8-7. In Kansas City, The Royals walked it off against Cleveland.
Lined up the left field line, fair. Royals win it. Hunter Dozier hit a bullet over the third baseman, and the Royals have swept the series.
Denny Matthews on 610 KCSP. The Padres have been hot, but on Sunday, David Peralta slowed them down in a pinch-hitting appearance.
Now the first one to Peralta. And David swings, hits it down the left field line. That ball's got a chance, and it is gone! A three-run pinch homer for David Peralta. His second home run of the season. And that lifts the Diamondbacks to a 6-2 lead over the Padres.
Greg Schulte, Arizona Sports, 98.7 FM. Arizona wins 8-4. In the Rockies and Giants game, Herman Marquez had a no-hitter through seven innings, and Nolan Arenado kept it alive in the eighth.
Brandon Crawford swings, hits a smash. Knocked down by Arenado. Bare hand pickup. Throw to first. He got him. Nolan Arenado keeps the no-hitter alive with a terrific play.
Oh, my goodness.
That on 850 KOA, but the no-hitter wouldn't last.
Here comes, swinging the ground ball into the hole. Diving is Arenado, not this time. It goes by him, it's a base hit to left field. And Longoria hit it sharply and right through the hole.
John Miller and KNBR. So the Giants got a hit, but they also got a loss. They dropped the game to the Rockies 4-0. The Pirates and the Nationals. And in the top of the ninth inning, Jason Martin came through for Pittsburgh.
Here's the pitch. And a fly ball toward left center. Going back and toward the track. And it's over the head of the left fielder, Soto. Bounces onto the track and over the wall. Jason Martin just doubled home Josh Bell with a go-ahead run. It's 4-3.
Sports Radio 93.7. The Fan. Pittsburgh wins there 4-3. The Rays win again. The Red Sox took care of business against the Orioles in Yankee Stadium. However, the problems for the Yankees continue.
And the 0-1, a swing and a line drive right center field. This is it well. To the track. At the fence. Slam. Sox lead on a grand slam by Tim Anderson over the scoreboard and right. Sox lead 4-2. Turn on the fireworks.
Ed Farmer on WGN.
Deep center field.
The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
So the game of the day, the Astros and the Mariners. And Josh, I know you've been on vacation because you constantly tell me all the time how you hate pitching highlights. And yet when we come back on the first day and you picked the game of the day, what did you pick, Josh?
I picked Garrett Cole's fantastic outing against the Mariners, full of pitching highlights, of course.
And what did that sound like?
Leg kick and the 3-2. That is on the outside corner for strike three. Moore goes down looking. He can't believe it. He thought it was off the plate. Thought he had ball four. But Cole picks up his ninth strikeout as he has retired the last seven in a row. One streak since they tied a franchise record with 12 straight wins back in 2018. Swing and a miss. Haniger goes down on an elevated fastball in. First time he's been retired today and the 10th strikeout for Cole. One out.
Really impressive off of a good hitter.
Here comes the 3-2. On the outside corner for strike three. Vogelback goes down looking at a 98-mile-an-hour heater. He wasn't happy with Todd Tischner on that last one.
Yes.
But the inning is over. 11 strikeouts for Cole, who's set down 10 in a row.
Great calls there, Buster. Great calls.
Unless you're part of Garrett Cole's family, or unless you're a member of the Astros, is that exciting? Robert Ford, KBME 790 AM, all kidding aside. Those are great calls. Garrett Cole was terrific. He set up the Astros for this in the top of the seventh inning.
Ledmus Diaz will lead things off for the Astros in the seventh inning. Brandon Brennan back out there after striking out two his last inning. And Diaz rips one to left field. Looking up Santana. This ball is gone! Ledmus Diaz gives the Astros a 3-2 lead with a line drive home run to left.
So the Astros are rolling again 3-2. But Josh, I'm glad you joined the dark side. You know, with it, you're into pitching highlights. I like that. Yeah. I can count on that moving forward.
Now, listen, Buster, I don't want to bring listeners too deep into the weeds here, but the difference between the pitching montage that I presented and the pitching montages that you regularly present is that my pitching montage was full of radio calls, whereas the pitching montages that you like to play are TV calls. Well, although great, they need that visual element. It's just It's just the ball hitting the mitt. We got some great descriptors there on the back to back to back K's by Garrett Cole.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm curious as we move forward. I'm curious to see as we move forward how many more times you pick pitching for highlights in your game of the day. Garrett Cole, AJ Hinch talked about those amazing highlights after the victory.
I just tried to stay under control and just keep executing as many pitches as I could. They're good offense and disciplined offense, and Hinniger and Santana at the top gave me some fits today, but we were able to navigate around and hold the lead, or hold the deficit rather, as long as we could. I thought command really of all four was pretty good. I was able to just kind of be on the corner and didn't really throw too many non-competitive pitches, so I was pleased with that.
We got, I think the leadoff runner got on base, and we just put a little bit of pressure on him. We weren't really able to do that. And he was doing a good job of getting some pop-ups above the zone a little bit, and he was pretty efficient with his pitches. So we put a couple things together, got him in some trouble, and then got a couple runs across. You know, we get to see him a couple times and then put up better at-bats as the game went on, and he didn't make many mistakes. I'm not even sure that the pitches that he gave up were mistakes, and then we're able to capitalize on the small opportunities that we had. So the bottom of the order did a really good job. Obviously, Brantley comes up with a big hit. Diaz gets the homer to get ahead, and we end up having a good win.
Seam heads rejoice.
Nerd alert!
It's Timmy time.
Is this a great game or what?
With Tim Kirkchen on Baseball Tonight.
Tim Kirkchen covers baseball for ESPN. And Tim, Jackie Robinson Day, you're going to be part of that discussion today, celebrating the legacy of Jackie Robinson, yes?
Yes, and really looking forward to it. We're going to have Ryan Howard doing his first game from the booth tonight, which should be fun. We're going to have all sorts of people helping us on this. We'll have Doug Glanville from the studio. We're going to have Jamie Foxx come upstairs, and he's throwing out the first ball tonight. And he's very much into African-Americans playing baseball and a big baseball fan himself. So that's going to be cool. It's going to be a great night in Philadelphia to celebrate just the impact that Jackie Robinson had, not just on the game, but on the country also.
Now, we talked about Jackie Robinson a lot on our broadcast last night. We had the same experience that you guys got last year. Actually, when I say we, I felt very jealous because I was down on the field. I actually asked our producer, Andy Reichwald, if I could go up to the booth to at least listen in and shake the hand of Hank Aaron, who was in our booth. Tim, that was amazing. And as I say, I know you guys had the experience last year. He talked about Jackie Robinson told a great story, which he told you guys last year about watching Jackie play a game of cards. And he told a story that I never heard before in the hours after he broke Babe Ruth's record, when he got home, he and his wife got down on their knees and prayed. And you get the sense when how he talks about that now and how he talks about Jackie Robinson that he really has only come to grips with what he experienced during that home run chase and what he experienced as an African-American player in retirement, if I'm making sense. In other words, it seemed like when he played, he just kind of put his head down and he played and he didn't really listen to things that were going on around him and tried not to really take it to heart. And he's done more of that, it seems, in retirement. What's your sense?
Oh, you're absolutely right about that, Buster. And if I may, I've covered 40 years, and that was the professional highlight of my career, sitting next to Hank Aaron for 4.5 innings last year and just asking him all the questions that I've always wanted to ask him. I've interviewed him before, but not in quite a setting like that. He told us the praying story that you guys heard last night. He told us that last year and so many other stories that I had never heard from him before, including where he got those incredibly powerful hands and wrists from. His dad used to carry giant blocks of ice up long sets of stairs with ice tongs, and that's how he developed that. Hank would go along with his dad. He was so great last year, and I'm sorry I missed it last night because I was traveling to get to Philadelphia, but I'm sure he was extra great last night, and just another reminder how great baseball is when somebody like Hank Aaron, who has been so important to the game of baseball, can join us and explain some things which very few people can like he can.
You know what's really cool? You know, before the game last night, we were talking to Brian Snitker, the manager of the Braves, and he talked about his relationship with Aaron, how Aaron was the one who actually hired him, the first person to hire him to be a manager in the minor leagues when Aaron was the farm director of the Braves. And he just talked glowingly about how, you know, Aaron would call him every, you know, week to 10 days and ask how he was doing, check in on him. He said, but he would pretty much let us do our jobs, and he just spoke so powerfully about him. But as a media member through the years, I you know, a number of times I'd try to reach out to him, I'd leave messages for him, I wouldn't hear back. And he seemed like more of a distant figure in the media, which is why when he did his segment with you guys last year, when he was on air with us last night, it was so cool to hear his laughter and his passion, and just the joy that, you know, he looks back on his career with.
Yeah, the smile he showed us last year, I expected it because I interviewed him in Cooperstown one year with Willie Mays. How cool is that? And the smiles those two guys shared together was unmistakable for me. And then we saw it last year, and he was just so at ease with his career, with his life, and with the game today. It was so good. And it's, again, something that I'll never forget, because I've never had a night covering this sport in 40 years like I did last year in Atlanta.
All right. Every week you get the first crack at the poll question that we post for the week. We have next Sunday the Braves for the third time this year on Sunday Night Baseball playing in Cleveland. And in light of that, the question is, who has the best rotation in baseball? And I only have four options in a Twitter poll: Astros, Indians, Nationals, and Rays. And I pick those four with all due respect to the Mets and Pirates, because you can make an argument that the Mets or Pirates should be in that group of four. But Astros, Indians, Nationals, Rays. Tim, who you got?
Well, I've got the Indians when everybody's healthy, of course. When Bieber is your fifth guy with that stuff, that's absurd. If Clevinger is indeed your fourth guy with that stuff, that's ridiculous. So I'll take the Indians with Corey Kluber at his best, which has not been this year, but will be, and Carrasco and Bauer to go with those five. I mean, I'll live with any of the four that you put out there. And at the beginning of the year, the Dodgers were saying they had the best rotation. The Cubs thought that they had a really good rotation. It just shows you how many great rotations are out there. But I'll take the Indians, assuming, of course, everybody's at their best and everybody's healthy.
Let me ask you, because I get a lot of pushback on Twitter in this. Would you have the Rays in this group of four and leave the Mets and Pirates out?
I would have the Mets in there instead of the Rays, even though, of course, the Rays have pitched better than anybody this year. But they've also done it with that amazing bullpen that they've put together. But those top three guys in that rotation for Tampa Bay are really good. And they only use an opener twice a week, sometimes only once a week with the other people they have. But I would have put the Mets in there just because when you can start with DeGrom, Syndergaard, Wheeler, Mats, Vargas, I think that belongs in the top four.
I hear you. In the last year, however, is Tyler Glasnow perhaps the most improved pitcher in baseball?
He's been great. I had somebody tell me, who went to scout the Pirates a couple years ago, he said, whatever they do, they need to keep that guy because it's going to happen. And when it does happen, no one's going to be able to hit him. And when they moved him, the same guy told me, I can't believe they traded him. You can't trade that guy. That's how good he's going to become. So, Buster, you're perfectly within rights to put the Rays there because nobody's pitched better than them this year. It's just that I think when you're looking at five, you got to have five major league starters, not openers involved.
Okay. Thanks for making me feel bad. I appreciate that. Beginning of a long week for me. The Houston Astros are playing great. They're 11-5 now, and I love seeing the fact that Jose Altuve is healthy and off to a great start. He keeps hitting homers. He's got seven now. He's batting 328. And Tim, we talked about this on the podcast a little bit at the end of last week. To me, when you look at it about Jose Altuve, it's amazing, even at age 28, how many boxes he's checked for Hall of Fame election. He's three-time batting champion, four times he's led his league in hits. He's an MVP in 2017. He was part of a World Series winning team. To me, and this is someone who's coming up on 1,500 hits, once he gets to 2,000 hits, it's a lock. What do you think?
Yeah, he's going to the Hall of Fame, Buster. There is no doubt in my mind about that, especially given the position he plays, which is a defensive position for the most part, and to be that great of an offensive player already is remarkable. These last 5 years have been a joke how good he has been. And you're right, he's checking all the boxes, but I'll never forget a couple of years ago, 3 years ago when they got knocked out of the playoffs by the Royals. He came into AJ Hinch's office with tears in his eyes and blamed himself for the Astros not winning that series. And that's how personal and important it is for him to carry the team. And AJ had to say, wait a minute, you're not blaming yourself for this. We lost. You didn't lose. And that's who Altuve is. But you look at these numbers adding up like this at this position, and it's happened so quickly and with the power involved. Don't forget, Alex Cora told me a couple of years ago, pound for pound, the strongest player in the major leagues is Jose Altuve. That's with Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton around, but he weighs 164 pounds, and he just had a home run in five straight games. He's an inch taller than me. That's pretty amazing.
The most surreal conversation I had with any player in baseball last year was with Jose Altuve, when in the aftermath of signing that $151 million extension, he looked at me and said, you know what, I'm overpaid. Like, I make too much. And I said, Jose, if you never played another game in your career, you'll have provided more value to the Astros than what they paid you in salary, according to how they calculate these things. He's been amazing.
Right. And not to get too corny about this, Buster, but this should tell every little kid out there that it doesn't matter what you look like. You can be 5'6", 164 pounds, and be the best or one of the best players in the league, as long as you have the skills to play this game and the commitment that it takes. He is the perfect example of how you can be really small and be great at this game. And that's what all our little kids should understand. If he can do it, they can do it if they put their mind to it.
Speaking of little guys who got paid, ask questions, and we talked a little bit about Ozzy Albies' 7-year, $35 million deal that he agreed to with the Braves last weekend. Tim, you know that he's gotten a lot of criticism for this contract. You know, the Braves have gotten some criticism for this contract. I felt at the time when the deal went down that a lot of the criticism was out of context and unfair. And to hear the stories over the weekend, and you think to put Ozzy in proper context, this is someone who, right after he signed professionally, his father died at age 40 of a heart attack. He was the oldest of three children. Growing up, and he told a mutual friend this, growing up, his family often struggled for food. Once a month, they would go to McDonald's, and that was like the big treat of each month growing up. At the end of 2016, when he was playing in the minor leagues, he took a swing and he fractured his elbow. He plays with a screw in his elbow. Ozzy Albies is a terrific player. He's not Ronald Acuna Jr. in terms of being an absolutely surefire superstar, because he's hyper-aggressive at the plate, and that usually doesn't change. He's had this injury history, and second basemen have not necessarily gotten paid that great in free agency the last few years. You know, DJ LeMahieu just got a 2-year deal after being an all-star. You saw Jonathan Scope non-tendered. Given what he's gone through, I don't know how anyone could take issue with Ozzy Albies taking this $35 million deal.
I'm totally with you on this, Buster. Look, could he have gotten more? Of course. Did the Braves get a bargain? My guess is, as we look forward, it's going to be a bargain. But a kid that grew up with nothing is offered $35 million a year, and we criticize him for taking that when he knows now he and his family will be set up for the rest of their lives, whether he gets another hit or not. and he's going to get a million more hits. But he's had trouble from the left side. He's a little guy. He's a free swinger, and he was not a great player after April last year. So you have to look at it that way. Even though he's betting on himself and he's going to be good, and I'm sure he will be, he's also best friends with Ronald Acuña Jr. They are inseparable. And now here's a chance to make sure he gets 7 years next to his best friend. Not everything should be, you know, looked at in where does he compare with the other salaries. Let's look at personal happiness here once in a while. I think we're allowed to look at that. And how could he not be a happy guy to get 7 more years with Acuña Jr. and make an enormous amount of money?
Yeah. So last night, you mentioned his relationship with Ronald Acuña Jr. I've never seen this before, where it's in the middle of a baseball game and there's competition going on, and you look in front of me in the dugout and there's Acuña Jr. and Ozzy wrestling. Okay. They're wrestling as the game is going on. They're kind of pushing and shoving, and then Johan Camargo got a big hit and they both jump up and they both celebrate. If anyone goes to Braves Twitter, they can see this scene right after the wrestling match took place. Tim, I said on air, it was like two kids that you have to separate in class.
Right. They're like two brothers, one just a tiny bit older, fighting down in the rec room and before mom calls them up to go eat. This is another reason why he signed that contract, so he can be with his buddy like that for all those years. I think that's a great thing for baseball. And I think all of these extensions, keeping star players or really good players in one place for 5, 6, 7, 10 years, I think this is good for the game, not bad for the game.
All right. Speaking of the Hall of Fame, Rena Benina tweeted at us this question, and I found this absolutely fascinating. You're the one who's better than anybody else at putting history into context. And she asked, despite struggles in 2019 so far, is Corey Kluber a legitimate candidate for Cooperstown? Now, I hit you with this question, Tim, sort of a blind side. I'll give you the career numbers. 97-57 in 204 games, 199 starts, an ERA of 3.10. He has just 1,322 innings, but in a five-year period, he won the Cy Young Award twice. Twice he finished in third place. He has an adjusted ERA plus of 137. Tim, that's 20th best all time. For me, he's still 2,000 innings short of where a lot of Hall of Famers are, and that's a lot of work to do. But man, he's had an impressive peak of his career.
It's more than an impressive peak, but he's not a Hall of Famer yet, and he shouldn't be a Hall of Famer yet. Dizzy Dean has the fewest wins of any starting pitcher ever to go into the Hall of Fame, and, you know, Kluber's got a long way to get to even Dizzy Dean. This is what you have to do as a starting pitcher, is you have to go out there. And if you're 2,000 innings short, I'm not so sure about that. Plus, you know, the Tim Lincecums of the world would then say, well, look at my five-year peak. I should be a Hall of Famer also. But it's career value, not just peak value. There are a lot of guys who belong in based on peak. But career is even more important to me. How long do you do it? How good are you for long periods of time? People penalize for longevity. I happen to give extra credit points for being good enough to be in a rotation for 15 years. Some guys for 20 years. That stuff matters. So Corey Kluber is not a Hall of Famer yet, but is he on the path? Absolutely. But he needs several more really good years to get there.
Now, you and I are wrong about so many things, but I got to give you credit. You were right about Byron Buxton when you told us in spring training that he seemed set up for a good year. This was the play that he made yesterday that got everybody in baseball talking.
Stewart reached on a fielder's choice his first time up, a drive to center. Buxton going back, still going back. He's at the wall, leaps, and makes the catch! Byron Buxton with a great catch right before crashing into the wall.
That was Dick Bremer on Fox Sports Minnesota with that call. Yeah, Tim, Byron Buxton so far this year hitting .324, .378 on base percentage. The Twins are playing well. You're going to take a victory lap. Go ahead.
No, I'm not taking a victory lap. I told you I'm not apologizing for being wrong about things, but I'm never going to say, hey, I was right about that, because I might be wrong anyway. All I'm telling you is when he took his shirt off, it was ridiculous how ripped he was and a completely different body type than the one that I saw last year. But more important than that, Buster, he was angry this spring. I had such a fun-loving conversation with him the previous spring about football and how hard baseball was, and there was none of that this spring. It was like, I'm not talking about anything funny, because he didn't say it, but he was angry about the way he had been treated. He was angry by the Twins not calling up in September, and I just sensed this guy is angry enough to go show everyone, I'm going back to the way that I used to play baseball, and I'm gonna go back to my old swing. And that's what I've seen and saw from Byron Buxton this spring. So it's really impressive. And I want you to throw this out there for all your Twitter followers and everyone on this show. Mr. Freeze in Atlanta. And we ran Byron Buxton against Mr. Freeze head up. Does Mr. Okay. Freeze win that race, or does Byron Buxton win that race? I think it's wildly competitive. Am I wrong about that? We should do it at the All-Star game. Am I wrong about that?
That would be really cool. And I think that Billy Hamilton would fight people to be in that race.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
I said this on the air the other night when we did a game in Atlanta. We should do this at the All-Star game. We should get Billy Hamilton, Byron Buxton, you know, D. Gordon, or, you know, somebody else, Gerard Dyson or Terrence Gore, and race Mr. Freeze at the All-Star game. I think it would be really cool. And I think Buxton gives him a run, for sure.
So, Tim, you, of course, participated in the great hot dog race in Milwaukee, right? Guess what the request I got was on Friday. Would you ever have
to
interest
race
in racing?
To race Mr. Freeze.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank God you said no. You said no, right?
Oh, my God. Of course I said no. Are you kidding? Josh, you want to chime in here? I knew you'd want to. Then I'm going to race the Freeze.
Yeah, well, I would have accepted because I fear no man, Buster. And you're talking to a guy who ran a 5.240 in high school. So I think I would have stood a chance against him. Absolutely. I would have put my best foot or feet forward and given him all I had.
Buster, let me just make a quick point about the hot dog race. I had zero interest in running in that. I resisted. And then Mike McQuaid, our boss, who I was afraid of then and I'm still afraid of, even though he's not my boss now, told me, you are racing in the hot dog race. I said, no, I'm not. He said, yes, you are. So I did. I only did because I was afraid of my boss.
Apparently I'm not afraid of Andy Reichwald to the point that I submitted, because I was like, no, I'm not doing that. There's no chance. You know, maybe 30 years ago, but no chance now. Three quick ones before you go. Kershaw pitches for the Dodgers tonight, returns the rotation. There's a great piece on ESPN.com about Kershaw and his need for a changeup. What do we expect for him as he works his way back into action?
Well, he's still really good, so I expect him to be good. But I think the key, like with Dustin Pedroia almost every game, is what's he going to feel like tomorrow after he pitches tonight? Let's say he goes five innings and pitches really well tonight. What's he going to feel like tomorrow? How is that body going to bounce back? Because now, to me, that's more important than does he throw hard enough, does he need another pitch, is physically, can everything hold up for the next start? Can it hold up the next day? And even though he's in tremendous shape, I think that's the bigger question. How is he doing physically the day after he throws?
And let's just get it out of the way. He's going to be throwing 88 to 90. Those days of him throwing 95 are past, yes?
Yes, they're over. But he's so good that, like, others have figured out how to win with 5 miles, 8 miles an hour less. That's what he's going to do.
Yeah, CC Sabathia being a great example. He showed that the other day at Yankee Stadium. I heard over the weekend that Dallas Keuchel at this point is bullish on the idea of a one-year contract. There's certainly a number of teams that could use him in that regard. Maybe the Phillies he'd be a good fit for. Maybe he'd be a good fit for the Mets. But I hear that the team that might be the best fit, the San Diego Padres, which makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know about you, Tim, but just knowing how excited that ownership group was, they spent all that money on Manny Machado. They're off to a good start. heck yeah, I think it would make sense. What about you?
Right. Just look at the East, though, first. What if he went to the Mets? What if he went to the Braves? What if he went to the Phillies? I mean, it might change that division. He's good enough to add an element that all three of those teams need. But the Padres are the perfect team for him. They have a bunch of young guys on that club. You bring in a guy who's pitched and won some really big games in his career, and you add it to a younger team like that, that would be the perfect spot for him. But again, if he's indeed, as you say, going to take potentially take a one-year deal, I think that's the best way to get this done and then try it again next year.
And before you go, I'm going to make you answer this question. Carl Ravage brought up the idea. You guys probably will talk about it on air tonight. If you came up with a baseball Mount Rushmore, who would the four be for baseball history? Between Carl and I, we came up with, of course, Babe Ruth has to be on there. Of course, Jackie Robinson has to be on there. Hank Aaron and Willie Mays. What do you think?
That's the four, Buster, for me. Jackie's number one, Babe Ruth's number two, Hank Aaron's number three. Four is debatable. There are a bunch of great options for number four, but I would put Willie Mays on there because when he came up in 1951, baseball had never seen anybody like him. No player had ever combined that kind of defense, that kind of power, and that kind of speed. Baseball had never seen an athlete like Willie Mays when he showed up. And given everything that he did in his career, I would put him fourth, although I'll listen to all sorts of offers at four. I just don't think you can change Jackie Robinson, Babe Ruth, and Hank Aaron, especially with how great Hank Aaron was and what he did for the game and the country with the way he carried himself during the chase and the passing of Babe Ruth.
And it could be that there might be a day where you consider Mike Trout in place of Willie Mays, is what I'm hearing.
Right. Certainly, because of the way he conducts himself. That's part of this. If you're going to be on a Mount Rushmore, you have to change the game in your own right. And Mike Trout is in the process of changing the game and showing people that you can be a great player, you can be a great guy, and you can stay your entire career, in theory, in one place and not be overtaken by the money and everything else in the game and just play. So sure, 15 years from now, we may say Mike Trout's on that list.
Yeah, there's no Millard Fillmore on Mount Rushmore. And there ain't going to be anybody like that on the baseball Mount Rushmore. Tim, thanks for doing this.
Okay, Buster. Talk to you soon.
This is Jackie Robinson Day, as we've been talking about. Bob Kendrick, the president of the Negro League Museum, was on Into the Night on ESPN Radio talking about Jackie Robinson. Give a listen.
In your childhood, what was Jackie Robinson to you? How did he affect you?
It was really interesting because as a kid growing up in Georgia, I saw the effect more on my parents, you know, because by the time Jackie died so young, and so I'm probably 12 or so by the time Jackie passes away. And so his impact really was seen through my parents. And I think that was the case, particularly for black folks all over the country, but particularly in the South. Jackie was a hero. And Jackie Robinson's breaking of the color barrier in many respects was as paramount as the first man landing on the moon in the African-American community, and they were no exception. So I think that is what I learned, you know, growing up as a kid, and then as fate would have it, now working at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum and having an opportunity to get a much more deeper and richer appreciation for the entire story, and then to be able to put it in context with those heroes of the Negro Leagues and of course, those leagues in which his career started. And so it kind of all has come full circle for me in many respects.
So when it comes to painting the full picture of Jackie Robinson, the man he was, where he came from, what he was a part of before he became the legend in our baseball annals today, how important is it for you to use Jackie Robinson and everything that he's done as a tip of the iceberg to what all he has accomplished and what all he came from?
Well, first and foremost, you can never reduce what Jackie did so courageously to just baseball. And I think you guys touched on it in your intro. as you were coming in, this is what sparked the civil rights movement in this country. And for those who believe that one person cannot invoke change, you need to look no further than Jackie Robinson. And when someone the magnitude of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the greatest civil rights leader in this nation's history, says he could not have done what Jackie did, that tells you the challenge that was ahead of him. Because when Jackie walked out on that field, he's by himself. And literally an entire race of people were going to be judged by his ability to play this game. So if he fails, an entire race of people would have failed. And so in a game that is a game of failure, yeah, baseball is a game of failure at its crux, and he cannot fail. And he was literally carrying 21 million black folks on his back when he walked across those lines as a member of the Brooklyn Dodgers. And so what he did was absolutely amazing. We should never forget Jackie Robinson.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Todd, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Buster. Good to see you here, Josh, as well.
Likewise, Todd.
All right. Every week before we get to our quiz, and I'm now two behind Josh in this year's quiz tally. But before we get to that, we always have cap talk, and this week's cap talk is about defunct caps.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that the defunct teams like, we'll throw a couple out there, the one-year wonder Seattle Pilots, the Houston Colt 45s, the Brooklyn Dodgers, Expos, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They gain this equity in the afterlife, and there's a mystery to them to me. So I thought it would be a good topic to talk, you know, a couple of our favorite defunct caps. Maybe if you could put it down to one. Imagine a world where we're seeing go throw out a team.
There's something really cool about that old Pilots logo. It's funny. Coincidentally, that was just when I was in Seattle recently, you know, looking at that, saying, you know, that's pretty neat. Certainly, in recent years, you've had some, but for me, no question about it, the Brooklyn Dodgers cap, which on today, April 15th, that would be appropriate. Yeah. I don't have a Brooklyn Dodgers cap. It's one that, and I made a note during the course of the winter. I'm like, you know what? I gotta get one of those next time I'm in Dodger Stadium. What about you, Josh?
Yeah. I mean, clearly the Dodgers cap is classic. It's a great look. The B certainly different from the Red Sox B, which makes it cool.
Yes.
The low-hanging fruit here is to go Expos. Just a great logo, great hat. I prefer the all-blue Expos hat as opposed to the red, white, and blue one. But I'm going to change it up a little bit. I actually like the old Angels hat, the navy Angels hat with the red bill, with the capital A with the halo, not the lowercase a. But the all-red Angels hat has never really done it for me. I like the blue and red one.
Wow.
That's a good choice. And it's interesting too, Josh, because if you remember a couple of years ago when we were talking greatest logos of all time, I had that Angels mark from the Nolan Ryan years,
yes,
let's say,
yes,
very, very high at the top of the list and was questioned in some instances. I'm going to throw a couple out there, and I'm just going to say that, you know, as with all of these things, our personal memories and how old we are and where we grew up enters into it. I have a brother who's 4 years older than me, and I remember inheriting one of his like Major League Baseball season preview 1970 books, this tattered paperback, and seeing, you know, this is like well into the 70s, and seeing the Seattle Pilots, like, what the heck are the Seattle Pilots? And why do they have these hats that look like airline pilots? So it was just, there's this, like I said, enduring mystery about the Seattle Pilots that intrigues me. But I do agree with Josh. I think that the aesthetics of the Expos, as I had in my book last year, Winning Ugly, there is something about that. And, you know, it's within our collective memories. So, but I do like the white panels. I just think, you know, you put a propeller on top and you're really in business there. No, talk about low-hanging fruit.
Yes.
The Houston Colt 45s, this 45 with an S, just bizarre kind of, but very direct messaging. And I think on this day of all days, on Jackie Robinson Day, to acknowledge the greatness of Jackie and how he elevated that Brooklyn Dodgers cap and the uniform, it is wholly appropriate. So one of these days we'll dig deep and we'll talk about like the 1909 Tigers caps, or we'll twist it around.
Who can forget those?
Yeah.
Ty
Cobb. That's right.
There you go. Now, you mentioned that a lot of your memories are you know, your favorite caps are tied to memories. I wonder if the Seattle Pilots logo would be as noted as it is and be embedded in our memories if not for the book Ball 4. What do you think? Which, of course, was a landmark book in baseball, yeah, written by Jim Boughton, where he was the first one. It was a tell-all. Let's face it. And all of a sudden, Mickey Mantle became a human being with the release of that book, to the degree that for decades, Jim Boughton was not allowed back at Yankee Stadium. He was not welcome at Old Timers Day. Is that, do you think, part of the legend of that team?
Unquestionably, you know, right there in that era of new journalism, we can compare Jim Boughton to, you know, Tom Wolfe or any, all this stuff.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, he talks about the uniform, and they had these wacky uniforms. The uniforms, incidentally, were designed in such a way they were supposed to wear metallic belt buckles like actual airline pilots wear, and the American League would not let them wear that. You can imagine the glint coming off of that potentially in a day game. But yeah, I think he talked about that, and it's a franchise that lasted for 162 games. It's just it's there's weirdness attached to the visuals and to the story, and of course Jim Boughton's really getting on top of this thing and letting us into a world that none of us knew about before has definitely a lot to do with it.
All right, let's get to this week's quiz. As I mentioned, I'm two down now to Josh. He's off to an early lead, as he was last year.
All right, here we go. This team removed the image of their mascot from their uniforms because they deemed it bad luck, and then they added it back 7 decades later. Is it the White Sox, the Giants, the Athletics, or the Pirates? Took the image of their mascot off of their uniforms because it was unlucky, and then they added it back 7 decades later. White Sox, Giants, A's, Pirates.
Oh, I'm not feeling confident about this one at all. Josh, you want to go first?
I know the answer, so I'd be happy to, but those aren't the rules, Buster, and I play by the rules. So you still need to go first.
All right. Oh, gosh. I'm going to go Athletics.
I actually didn't know the answer. I had it between two. The A's were one of them, but using history as my guide, I'm going to say the White Sox.
Buster!
Yeah, baby!
I was thinking Black Sox scandal. And so I was thinking after that happened, they would take the little white sock off their uniform, and then obviously they have since put it back.
Yeah, well, it was Connie Mack.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say this. Connie Mack, 1920, takes the elephant because, you know, okay, so he sold off the entire dynasty, and the Athletics basically, you know, sink into the swamp of MLB for years. So they take the elephant off, and it kind of kicked around for a few years after that in the 20s. But if you remember, in the late 80s, on the cusp of another little dynasty, the A's bring the elephant back. I think it was 1987, and they appear in the World Series those couple of years and win the World Series in 89 over the Giants. So there you go.
Speaking of dynasties, headed toward another year of championships.
Getting awfully cocky for still being down, Buster.
To build on my dynasty. That's okay. We know this trajectory. I'm used to it. We've seen this story before. We've read this story before. Todd, thanks for doing this.
All right, boys. Good talking to you.
When Jacob deGrom was at Stetson University, he was a shortstop. And for months, he resisted the idea of pitching. He flat out did not want to pitch. I spoke to Pete Dunne, who was DeGrom's coach at Stetson, and Steve Barningham, the Mets Southeast cross-checker, in preparation for a piece we ran on DeGrom on ESPN.com Sunday about DeGrom's reluctance to pitch. Then on Sunday, I followed up with DeGrom. Please give a listen to some of that interview.
If you can sort of illuminate us on the story that the summer before your junior year, when you were going to play summer ball, and the coach said, hey, we don't have a bat for a shortstop, we'd love to have you pitch, and you were like, no, it's okay, I'll take the summer off.
That's what's been told to me by a couple people.
Yeah, I didn't really know I was going to pitch going into my junior year. That was the first I had really heard about it was once the fall practice started, like, hey, we might use you to close, but, you know, I kind of struggled offensively and freshman and sophomore year, so I had a batting cage at my house, and I would take ground balls almost every day with my dad, so I went to that summer league
thinking that I was going to be playing some infield and being able to at least hit and work on some stuff. And when I found out that wasn't the case, then I figured I should probably work on what I thought I was going to be doing in college. But there's times when I look back at it and I'm like, man, I wish I wouldn't have left. And then there's times because I ended up having Tommy John surgery. I ended up getting hurt, when was that, July, and didn't have surgery till October. So who knows what would have happened if I would have kept throwing and, you know, pitching throughout that summer.
Yeah, you're right. The timing, you might have been right on the bird.
You never know. So looking back, there's part of me that's like, man, I wish I would have, you know, just kept playing. And, you know, part of me's like, you know, maybe I would have blown sooner.
And the baseball gods never would have found you as a pitcher.
Never.
What did you do that summer instead of playing on the summer ball team?
I would hit every day and then, like I said, take grounders almost every day. You know, that was something I did from when I was little with my dad, and he ended up putting a batting cage up at our house, and that was just something we did. He would be home from work about 4:30, and I'd be over there to hit and take grounders and throw.
Did you have any kind of a summer job or anything like that? Or you just
that year? I don't know if I worked that year. From when I was 16, I started working. 15 or 16, I started working summers.
Doing what?
I worked in a fernery for 2 years, and then I worked at a sports complex in DeLand, Sperling Sports Complex. We would mow and just take care of the fields. They had softball fields and baseball fields and soccer fields.
You said you were at a fernery? What's that? I've never heard of that.
It's plants. That's when I was in high school.
F-E-R-N then. Fernery is in ferns.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yep.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, Pearson is right down the road from me. So it's DeLand, DeLeon, and Barberville, Pearson, and I think it's the fern capital of the world. They ship all over the place to go in flower arrangements.
So when, and the way that he described it, he said when he asked you initially about being the closer, you said, well, can I still play shortstop? Mm-hmm. And then he goes, yeah, you can. And then when they brought to you 15 games into your junior year and they said, we're going to move you into the rotation, you asked the same question. Well, what about shortstop? He said, well, you can't play short on Saturday. Maybe on Tuesday and Wednesday you'll be fine. What do you remember about that conversation?
Yeah, I didn't love it at first because I really did enjoy playing infield. At the time, I mean, hadn't pitched much. You know, I think the main reason they moved me there because I knew where I was throwing the baseball. So it was a work in progress with off speed, and you know, it was never really good in college. I don't think everything started coming together till after I had my Tommy John surgery. The rehab crew that I had down there noticed some things with how I threw, moved my arm slot up a little bit to take some stress off my elbow, and that was really the first time that I had like a pitching program, because I would play some. I played some first after I would pitch in college, played right a couple times, played some short, so I was never really, you know, in just a pitching routine. So trying to, you know, figure out how to get outs and playing a lot was kind of tough for me.
What was your, I mean, it's just that everyone says you love to play shortstop, mm-hmm. and you love that part of it. Did you have an aversion to pitching? Was it boring for you?
I didn't want to have to sit there and watch a bunch of games. I'd rather be playing in them. You know, now it's not bad because I have a set routine that I do to get ready. So it's like I'm doing something. But, in college, I had no clue, really. I was very new to pitching and thought it would be – I thought it'd be more fun if I was able to play those games that I wasn't pitching.
Have you ever thought back and say, boy, if I hadn't switched to pitching, what should be doing in life?
Yeah. You know, even when I was little, the dream was to play Major League Baseball. And, you know, there's a lot of kids that say that, but I don't think I ever had a plan B for it. That was plan A, and that's what I was going for. Whether it was I wanted to be an infielder, but once I started pitching and got drafted as a pitcher, I felt like it was time to really figure out how to do that and try to learn everything I could from the people I was around to try to be the best that I could be on the mound.
He said that watching you pitch last year, the thing that made him the most proud was how you reacted to the adversity every mm-hmm. start out, that it was a close game, often runs wouldn't be scored. He said he could never see a change in your demeanor. Where do you think that came from?
I try to keep it pretty, you know, not get too high, not get too low. My dad's real low-key like that, easygoing. And, you know, I had a bad temper when I was younger, real young, and then kind of grew out of it. And
on the field?
No, not really on the field. I've always played pretty even keel. Just I never want to let anybody on the other side let them know that something bothered me. So I just try to keep it under control out there. You know, there's times where I'm very frustrated. But, you know, like I said about last year, these guys, they were more frustrated than I was. You know, they were out there grinding away, trying to score a run for me, and just weren't able to do it. And, you know, I'm very appreciative of how they went about it. They were, all of them, were true professionals. You know, they all felt bad, but it's part of the game. You know, it seemed like every time I matched up with somebody, they threw the ball really well. And we battled. We just weren't able to win those baseball games.
Thank you.
Yep.
Bleacher Tweets.
The rest of the Bleacher Tweets, Buster, start with this one from the Starting Block, fittingly, at the Starting Block. Says the talk before the season for the Giants was that Madison Bumgarner would be the player to bring back decent prospects. Given the struggles of so many bullpens and the Giants bullpen actually being pretty good, do you think the pen will actually bring the assets at the deadline?
Block, you know how volatile bullpens can be.
Yeah.
You get the feeling that a guy who's really hot right now, who knows where he's going to be in June and July. That's what it's going to come down to for so many of these relievers and what their actual value is once we get closer to the deadline. How healthy are they and how are they throwing?
P.K. Steinberg next up. At P.K. Steinberg wants to know, what do you think is the biggest reason for Yoan Moncada's hot start in 19? Because to me, it seems like a complete 180 from previous seasons.
I didn't check the numbers, PK, on this, but I guarantee you that if I went into that Fangraphs page for Moncada, the percentage of him chasing out of the zone would increase dramatically. I've seen so many hitters where you've seen improvement this year, and you go back and you're like, yep, that's what the guy's doing. And Moncada, it's always been about the chase rate. And you're assuming if he's having success, that's probably gotten better.
A lot of Bleacher Tweets came in, Buster, about that Mount Rushmore of baseball. One of them is from Robert Beretta, at Holler at Rob. Says, Buster, I noticed there were no pitchers mentioned in the Mount Rushmore of baseball. Can we get some love for the hurlers, please?
Yeah, Josh, I'm going to have you chime in on this in a second to give me your Mount Rushmore. We were going back and forth with Carl the other day, and, I mean, Babe Ruth has to be on there.
Yep.
Okay? Hank Aaron has to be on there. Yep. I think Jackie Robinson, his historical figure, has to be on there.
Yep.
And I've got Willie Mays on there.
Me too.
But I can't think of a pitcher. Sandy Koufax, amazing career. Walter Johnson, Cy Young. I can't think of a pitcher who would supersede any of those. What about you?
Me neither. And I'd love to say that I disagree. Like yourself, I'm a huge Koufax guy. But he just, you know, in order to put him in, you got to bump somebody off. And you just can't do that. And I mean, I got love for hurlers too, obviously. But I just can't see Sandy Koufax or any other pitcher superseding any of the four guys that you put on there. My Mount Rushmore is exactly the same as yours. I hate to say it because I hate to agree with you. Finally, Buster, this one from Toph at TJost14. With all this talk about Game of Thrones, Buster, it has me wondering, do you watch anything other than sports, sitcoms, dramas, maybe some Law and Order perhaps?
A lot of movies. Watch a lot of movies. Game of Thrones, it's funny because everyone's excited about it. I have never seen an episode of
Me
Game
neither.
Of Thrones.
Me neither.
And it's not we're kind of losers, I think, right? But here's the thing. I have a good excuse. This runs on Sunday night, right?
That's
and
true.
I've been working on Sunday Night Baseball for 9 years, so probably not a surprise. But yeah, I'm a big movie buff. And I'm sure, Josh, you can recognize this line from one of the greatest movies of all time. You ready for it?
I'm ready.
2 days ago, I saw a vehicle that could haul that tanker. You want to get out of here? You talk to me.
I don't know. Is it like my cousin Vinny or something? What are we talking about?
Road Warrior, Mel Gibson.
Oh, yes,
this is like the critical scene in the movie. Come on.
Yeah, and your Australian accent. You talk crap about my Australian accent. Yours is way worse. Way worse.
Oh, yeah. Man. We got to hear from Bleacher Tweeters about that.
Absolutely. And please, when you talk smack to Buster, use the hashtag.
It wasn't good. I needed to hearten that up a little bit.
Terrible.
Can I get a reset tomorrow?
Nope.
Oh,
that was your one chance. I can't wait for people to get after you. Use the hashtag Bleacher Tweets when you do so.
Man, that's it for today. My thanks to Jacob DeGrom, to Bob Kendrick, to Tim Kirkjian, to Josh McGree. Who else are we thinking here? And Todd Radom.
Todd Radom, of course.
Of course, with our
Todd?
Quiz.
Yeah.
I know, exactly. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.